Hi, everybody. In this episode, we're discussing the book Talking Back to Purity Culture. So we'll be talking about purity culture and the trauma that it has caused, sex, rape and rape culture, and sexual abuse. We want to let you know this ahead of time so you can take that into consideration if you are listening around children or if any of these topics are triggering or difficult for you to listen to right now. Also, because we do talk about sexual abuse in the context of church, we want to mention how important it is for churches to deal with reports of sexual abuse appropriately and take necessary legal action. Thanks for listening, and now let's get into the episode. Hey, I'm Savannah.
And I'm Adi, and we're the Pulidos.
We're here talking about simplifying our life, growing and loving our family, and learning about the world.
And today we're talking about talking back to purity culture. Welcome, everybody. Welcome back to the Pulidos podcast, and it is a good day.
So I know that we've probably talked about this topic on this podcast more than anybody signed up for, but I'm going to bring it up again. Have you seen the new Lego set that just came out? I think it just came out. That's NES Mario Lego set.
No.
It's like I'm pretty sure it's like the Builders set. Collection?
No.
Okay, look at it right now.
Right now?
Yeah, you have to see it.
I kind of stopped
paying attention
to the Lego sets.
That's fine.
So the new Lego NES.
Yeah.
Hold on. Hard to find. Oh yeah, this?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I've seen this before.
Oh, you have?
It's pretty crazy. Yeah. It just came out, right? It's available now on $300. No, $230.
Oh, wow, that's expensive.
That's so expensive, but it looks pretty cool.
I know. Doesn't it look cool?
It's
like an old school TV that you build, and then it has Mario on the TV.
And you could crank, there's a little cranky thingy, and you could crank Mario. And
so he moves?
He moves.
That's so cool.
Yeah, and so it's the old school Nintendo Entertainment System, the NES, and it comes with a little controller, the little console, a TV. This is all made out of Legos, by the way, so you can't really play cool. It.
No,
but it looks very cool.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
Oh, and actually, you can, in a way, can play it with a Lego Mario, and you could activate the Mario, runs on battery, and you can make it jump and stuff, and it's pretty cool.
Oh, like the one our kid had?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Looks very cool.
But is that part of the Lego Builders, like the one for adults?
Yeah, it's for like adults.
Yeah. It's pretty cool, right?
Really retro looking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's awesome.
I like that.
That's a cool gift idea.
I know. It's very cool.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's all I had. Let's get down to the nitty gritty.
Well, the day has finally come that we've been talking about for a long time.
Yeah.
That we are going to be reviewing the book Talking Back to Purity Culture.
Written by
Rachel Joy Welcher.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, beyond just reviewing it, we're not just saying like, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down. We're talking about the book and just talking about the things that stood out to us in it and what we learned and some good things that were brought up.
Yeah.
So basically, we're going to be kind of going through the book generally in order.
Yeah.
From start to finish. But we're just going to be talking about the things that stood out to us along the way.
Yeah.
So this is a book that is about purity culture. So purity culture is a subculture, usually within the context of Christianity.
Yeah.
That puts a very high emphasis on sexual purity.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that became really popular, I believe, in like the 90s. I think that's correct.
Yeah.
In the book, it talks about how purity culture was largely in response to kind of like the sexual revolution and like sexual promiscuity and the sort of issues of like STDs and things like that that were coming to light and become and being seen as a big problem culturally in like the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
I might not have that exactly right, but generally that she talked about how that it was kind of a response to that.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of looking to solve this problem and to make abstinence and purity popular.
Yeah.
And one of the things that is talked about in this book, and there's also a documentary that she references a lot in the book, was that it was kind of like trying to make abstinence sexy.
Yeah.
And trying to basically really promote this idea of waiting and saving sex for marriage. So there's a lot that kind of goes into that. There are more like overt things like purity balls and like dances that people would go to, like fathers and daughters, purity rings that, you know, that people would wear as a outward symbol of their desire to save themselves for marriage, purity pledges, like abstinence pledges that people would sign, purity rallies and things like that. And those are kind of the more like visible out there things.
Yeah.
But then there's a lot of more subtle and like nuanced and underlying currents that I think really crept into a lot of church culture and a lot of especially church culture for young people, for like middle schoolers, high schoolers, and young adults. And I think that while the popularity of those things has died down quite a bit, there's still a lot of influence of purity culture that you can see in churches and in culture today.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the background of what purity culture is. Let's talk briefly about kind of our own like interaction with it, which I think we may have in another episode. I can't remember. But so for me, I didn't really interact with purity culture on kind of that really loud and proud level of like going to the rallies and signing pledges and things like that. But I did hear a lot of the purity talks from youth leaders and things like that. And I heard a lot about True Love Waits was a big movement and a big like organization. And I did have a purity ring that I wanted to wear as like a symbol of this desire to save sex for marriage and how important I thought that was.
Yeah.
And I heard a lot of teachings about modesty and how dressing modestly, how that was related to sexual purity and how that was related to specifically the sexual purity of men in my life.
Yeah.
So I heard a lot of those messages. And for the most part, I feel like it wasn't something that was like pushed on me. It was something that I kind of actively wanted to like participate in. And I also read several of the books that kind of were coming about at this time, like I Kissed Dating Goodbye. And I think a couple other ones that I read that Rachel actually talks about in this book in Talking Back to Purity Culture.
Yeah.
I definitely was pretty familiar with a lot of the books and the messages that were out there for like young women.
Yeah.
So basically to sum it up, I feel like I was kind of in the throes of purity culture, but I wasn't like in the trenches of it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. But I definitely would identify with kind of growing up in that time and in that context. What about you?
I want to say throughout this book when I was reading this, and actually as soon as I started reading that dedication section, after I read it, I was just thinking like, I won't be able to fully relate to the book.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I wasn't fully affected by purity culture at all. But after reading the whole book, I realized that even though I wasn't in the like the trenches, or I wasn't aware about all the movement, the purity culture movement within the Christian church, even though I wasn't aware of it or aware about like the purity rings and all that stuff, I kind of dealt with purity culture kind of like later on in my life. Like I kind of was exposed to a little bit about that, like with some books or with the way the vibes I got from church or like the talks, you know. So I kind of got the little aftermath of this big wave movement in the 90s, you know.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
As soon as I started reading the dedication, the first couple of words, I just kind of paused. I was like, oh, this book is going to be really good for people that were fully into like in the purity culture movement and were affected by it, you know, and especially women. And it says to the hurting, to the abused, and the angry, and it keeps on going. I'm not going to finish the whole thing, but the first three words caught my attention: to the abused. And I just kind of had this weight on my shoulders and just thinking like, oh, like this is, like this is a thing that happened,
mm-hmm.
and is still alive.
Yeah.
And I wasn't like in a way like fully affected by it like you.
Mm-hmm.
I have to acknowledge that first, that I am in a way kind of like an outsider looking in,
mm-hmm.
because I wasn't like involved in that world, in the Christian world, till later on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't hear about the term purity culture until, honestly, I think it was while we were like, I think, dating towards kind of the end.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that this book is not worth reading if you maybe relate like as like a quote unquote outsider, or mm-hmm. someone that, as a guy, especially as a male, because I think after reading this book, I am convinced that, again, like I think I was affected by it differently,
mm-hmm.
which I'll share a little bit now, but I'll get more into it later.
Mm-hmm.
Like certain books that she will, like she challenges and dissects here in this book and says like, well, these authors from these books say certain things that are not okay.
Yeah.
Those books actually I had here in our like bookshelf, and that's because I brought those books from my previous church.
Yeah.
And I lived in a discipleship house, which I'm not sure if I mentioned here in the podcast before, but when it was moving day, when everybody was moved out of the house, I got a ton of free books, Christian books, and mm-hmm. and a couple of those were actually some books that were mentioned here in this talking back to purity culture book.
Yeah.
And my intent was to read those books because it looked like a cool book. And I thought like, well, since these books were in the discipleship house, that means that these are worth reading.
Yeah.
You know? And I had a catchy title. One of them was Every Man's Battle.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was Wild at Heart.
Yeah.
My intent was to read those books and to see like what the whole fuss was about, these books and stuff. Anyway, after I think I got rid of those books because I never read them and I wanted to. But anyway, after reading the Talking Back to Purity Culture, I realized like, wait a minute, like I think that I felt really relieved that I wasn't part of it, mm-hmm. in that way, you know?
Yeah.
Because I felt like as a male, it seems like it would have really damaged the way that I viewed women,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel for women that have been affected this way.
Mm-hmm.
That first paragraph was powerful to me to read, and I was like, oh my gosh, this book is going to help me understand what purity culture is. If any guy out there, whether you were part of this purity culture or not, or you feel like an outsider, don't know like what purity culture is or was affected by purity culture, like I think I would definitely recommend this book.
That's really good, and I think your perspective is definitely helpful to have and to see, you know, what this looks like from an outsider's perspective, and also to see how you maybe were affected by certain ideas and beliefs, even without, you know, without realizing or without having that like label for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that anybody who is part of the church, that this is a really important thing to learn about and understand, because I think that especially for women, but I think for men in different ways, and we'll have been damaged by this a lot as well. And we'll get into all of that. But I think that for women who might be in your church or just in your like sphere of influence, that you might not understand why they're dealing with trauma when topics come up like modesty. And when, you know, when things come up about what God says about sex and things like that, and why those things might be triggering and re-traumatizing to them.
Yeah.
When to you, it doesn't seem like a big deal.
Right.
And so I think that this is a topic that's really important for anybody in the church to look at, even if you feel like, well, I wasn't affected by it, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. I think it's a good metaphor. And like, hopefully these examples or the way that I'm talking about this, using certain terms, I don't want to offend anybody or marginalize people,
mm-hmm.
women that were affected by this. To apologize if that those certain words and stuff or metaphors have come across that way. I'm just thinking like let's say you were the one that you were involved in stuff, and it's like you were the one that ate the bread, and even though I wasn't involved and I didn't eat the bread, I still found some breadcrumbs, mm-hmm. in my life.
Yeah.
from the same bread, same source, and didn't know what was like the full bread until later on, until we had these talks. And after we read this book, I was like, oh yeah, there was a lot of breadcrumbs in my life from the purity culture.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
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 So one of the main themes of purity culture is the idolization of virginity. And that is actually the title and the topic of the second chapter of this book.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about how in purity culture, purity is basically equated to virginity. And for both men and women, that was really the topic, was that I would sometimes hear conversations about the importance of, you know, purity in thought and purity of your heart.
Yeah.
And that was important too. But generally, it was like, well, the main thing that people could control is like just telling people like don't have sex.
Right.
And so your virginity was pretty much equated to your purity.
Yeah.
And in this chapter, Rachel talks about how that's not biblical at all, and how our purity comes from Christ and his righteousness. And there's a quote here from the book where she says that purity culture basically teaches this, that a woman's worth rests not in her soul, but between her legs, as if virginity were some remnant of pre-fall righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for some reason, and I don't totally understand this, that there was a lot more emphasis put on women's virginity,
yeah,
and seeing that as this like precious gift, and you know, this flower, like there's all these metaphors, and it was just seen as this super important thing for you to guard. And I think, is it in this chapter, or is this might be from somewhere else that I'm getting this, where it talks about how there isn't any other sin or any other thing that we talk about as like, it's just a one time, like you either have it or you don't.
Right.
Like either you're a virgin or you're not.
Yeah.
And that is, it's just so unbiblical.
Right.
Like when, and she talks about how the Bible does say that sex is designed for marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not wrong to believe and to teach that sex before marriage is not good, and that it is sinful.
Right.
But it isn't an all or nothing thing. And that's and our purity doesn't come from our virginity status or our sexual status.
Right. Yeah. Totally. Here on page 19, as I talked about virginity as worth, this sentence, that this helped me understand purity culture. And it says here, if purity culture were a throne, virginity would be the queen sitting on it. And I think that made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Understanding purity culture and that virginity is put up there on a pedestal and is idolized. And then another big topic that is discussed in this chapter is virginity as identity.
Yeah.
And like, I understand that, like, I could see it that people, women have put that status, that identity in themselves, and when it comes down to purity, remaining pure, that if you're a virgin, that means that you're doing a good job. And like that just really could cause a lot of confusion and a lot of like self-guilt, shame.
Yeah.
When stuff happens or you feel like you're impure. And like once you put that as your identity, and instead of like putting other things like that God calls you, you know, as your identity, it just really messes your state of mind and physical state, you know. And another thing here that was mentioned is that sexual self-control is a lifelong pursuit.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, totally agree with that. I think after reading this book, I realized that staying pure was described within the purity subculture, that if you just wait until you're married, then you know you're gonna be promised all these things and you're gonna be okay, and that's it. Your whole like struggle with lust or, you know, certain thoughts and stuff, like that's gonna be fine once you're married, because sex belongs in marriage, which is true, but like the sex is now like kind of wrapped as a gift and presented as a reward at the end of the line.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like, that's not the case. Like we have issues, like daily issues, regardless whether you're married or not. Like there's going to be that, you know? And so I thought it was pretty cool to read that, like throughout the book, to realize that, like, yeah, like sexual self-control is a lifelong pursuit. Mm-hmm. It's not just like while you're dating and that's it.
Yeah.
Certain things are portrayed as like, here's the start and the end line, finish mm-hmm. line here, you know, and yeah. the marriage is always going to be the end finish line.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And within purity culture, there were so many phrases that I think got thrown around really casually that if you really think about what it means, like saving yourself for marriage. Mm. And so it's like, it's definitely seeing that as like the only reason to stay a virgin is like for marriage.
Yeah.
And so she gets into this later, but, you know, talking about how like that was definitely going under the assumption that everybody was going to get married.
Yeah.
And then also even just the phrase like staying pure until marriage, it's like that's definitely implying that once you're married, now you're impure.
Right.
And she talks about how a lot of people who were really steeped in purity culture really struggled mm-hmm. with their sex life when they were married, because for so long they had been told that sex was bad and dirty and impure.
Yeah.
And so that you were just supposed to like flip this switch from like being this you know, perfectly chaste virgin to now being a like fully active sexual being.
Right.
Yeah. And how that, I think for a lot of people, was just very confusing.
Right.
Because it was like almost you were supposed to kind of like deny your own sexual nature
yeah.
until this finish line. And then now it's like you can let all of that out.
Right.
But that's very confusing, especially with those terms of like saving yourself until marriage or remaining mm-hmm. pure until marriage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah, that definitely mess up with like, again, your identity, right? And while you're dating or courting, and then once you're married, that also messed up with your psyche. Like, mm-hmm. I think that, again, there's a lot of these promises said, and once you get to like the honeymoon or like the first month and you're realizing, wait a minute, I was expecting to have this amazing sex, but it's mm-hmm. not happening, or your identity as a virgin is done.
Yeah.
Like it's removed. You're no longer a virgin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just, and she talks about an episode from Jane the Virgin, which actually that episode was just, we just watched that.
And I've been rewatching the show.
Yeah. You're watching the show. And then you ended up in that episode. And the episode, you haven't seen it, like watch it. It's, you know, she's her identity, the whole title, the whole show, it's called Jane the Virgin. And she is this virgin, right? And so she puts virginity as like a big, you know, this on this pedestal, mm-hmm. right? And once she has sex, it's like, oh, wait a minute, how come I feel off? Well, the thing is because
she felt like she lost a part of who she was.
Yeah, because that was a big part of your identity, and yeah. now it's like removed. It's like, well, I'm Jane the what now, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The next topic that the book dives into, which I found really interesting, and it was one of those topics that reading it, I just kept feeling like, yes, like that encapsulates so much of so many of the messages that I heard, and I think so many other women heard, that I never, it's one of those things that's like, oh, okay, I finally have the words to like explain this.
That's good.
And that was the idea of female responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And specifically, she talks about the quote, moral superiority of women. And so in this chapter, I first want to make note of this one sentence that I thought was super powerful. She's talking about the story of a woman who I think she interviewed in like preparing for writing this book.
Yeah.
And talks about an experience that she went through. And she says her very femaleness felt like a weapon that she had no desire to wield.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sentence alone is so powerful, and just explaining the way that I don't think it was intentional or realized, but how purity culture just taught women that their bodies are dangerous and that they're to be avoided. And we'll get into that more when we talk about the way that men are portrayed in purity culture.
Yeah.
But this is the effect that it had on so many women, of just constantly being told that their body needed to be covered up, that it needed to be looked away from and avoided.
Right.
It was like this weapon.
Yeah.
And so in this chapter, she goes into how a few really pivotal things here. And I think one of them is that in purity culture, the sexual desire of women is downplayed. And this is something that she talks about, how this is also reflected in culture at large.
Right.
And she talks about how, like, on sitcoms, you would mm-hmm. see the kind of joke, like, funny scene of the husband wanting to have sex and the woman saying, like, oh, I'm tired, or I don't,
like not tonight.
Not tonight. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how that was something that was really, reflected in culture at large. And then in purity culture, mm-hmm. it was talked about a lot in the context of, like, men are the ones who struggle with lust.
Yeah.
Men are the ones who struggle with pornography addictions.
They're sexually aroused by visual mm-hmm. Stimuli.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember hearing all kinds of things about that, of like, men give intimacy to get sex and women give sex to get intimacy. Mm. And it was that idea of like, what women really care about is the emotional side, and the sex is just like a duty.
Yeah.
Because of that, I think so many women grew up feeling just ashamed of their normal sexual desire
mm-hmm.
and feeling like there was something wrong with them mm-hmm. or that they were like perverted because of the way that, because they are sexual beings.
Yeah. Along with that, I also like highlighted similar themes, and I highlighted the part here where it says women are less tempted by sex. This is, I think, she references a lot of and quotes a lot of authors from mm-hmm. all these books, and talks about like what they have said. And so there's this theme of like, women in like the purity culture, they're viewed as like they are not really tempted by sex, or mm-hmm. that they lust, and then also that sets women up to be these guardians of sexual purity.
Yeah.
So the duty here for women is to keep men in check.
Yeah. And so women are set up now in this position to not only have to guard their own purity, their own quote unquote flower, but they also are supposed to guard the purity of men.
Yeah. So they're responsible for the men's struggles or men's sexual temptation.
Yeah.
Along with that point, she mentions that there's little to no advice for men about how to help women avoid lust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the other side of the coin, it's like, well, there's all these like rules and responsibilities for women, like what to do to help your partner, to help men in the church. But there's, on the other side of it, there's no help at all. Like little to no advice for men to like help women.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was definitely a huge double standard with the way that modesty was talked about in the church. And there was never any advice or rules or prescriptions given to men regarding mm-hmm. dressing modestly. And I think that, again, just reinforced the idea of like the female body is the problem.
Yeah.
And the female body is the problem. And then the men are the ones who have this insatiable like desire for sex and that just are constantly lusting.
Right.
So she talks in this chapter about dressing modestly, because I think that goes along with, you know, that's part of the female responsibility
mm-hmm.
is to dress modestly so that you don't cause your brother to stumble. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was mm-hmm. something that I think anybody who even grew up like in the fringes of purity culture has heard that before. Like you don't want to cause your brother to stumble.
Right.
And this, I think, is... Oh, yeah. She's quoting somebody here where she says, this person, growing up, she often felt she was just a stray bra strap away from causing one of her male friends to sin or sexually assault her.
Yeah.
And that's heartbreaking, but I think mm-hmm. that really rings true to the messages that were given, that any wrong move, any wrong mm-hmm. You know, outfit choice or gesture or anything was going to cause the men around you to quote unquote stumble, meaning to lust after you or to not be able to control their thoughts, or, you know, in some situations to, like it says, to assault you.
Right.
And it says, I'm going to read this little part right here from page 43, where it says, The rhetoric is confusing to young women. Are men brave princes, or are they dragons that must be tamed? Mm-hmm. Or maybe women are the dragons.
Totally. Yeah, that's well said. And it just makes you think that women's body, that's your problem, that mm-hmm. you have a woman's body.
Yeah.
There's all these rules you have to follow in order to protect the men in your life. And if they lust after you, then that's your fault. Mm-hmm. You got to work better and do a better job, cover certain things, or, you know, move certain ways. And then even if things are done to you, mm-hmm. it's still your fault.
Yeah.
The individual sin is not individual anymore. It's not like the man's sin. It's now the woman's like responsibility to fix that sin for the guy, mm-hmm. to make him not lust after you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very sad.
Yeah. And I do appreciate how she is able to also find the nuance here by saying, mm-hmm. here it says, we don't have the freedom to judge others based on dress, but we do have the freedom to consider them in how we dress. And so she talks about how as Christians that we can and we should be considering other people when we're making decisions about mm-hmm. clothes. Mm-hmm. That, you know, everything that we do should be done to God's glory and to show love to the people around us. And that can include how we dress. And it should include yeah. how we dress. But that is such a far cry from the messages that were being presented in purity culture, because the way that you're choosing to dress to love the people around you, even if that does include
yeah.
choosing to not dress in a provocative way, mm-hmm. that doesn't make you responsible for the sin of another person. And there's just such a far cry from what the Bible actually teaches and what we can, you know, infer from like the heart of God about these things and what mm-hmm. was being, you know, spewed out by this purity culture, like nonsense.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So beyond the modesty issue, she talks about this idea that it's also the woman's responsibility to attract a spouse. And yeah. I think that was something that I read about a lot in books that were marketed toward young Christian women mm-hmm. was this idea that you have to, you know, you want to be attractive to men and you want to be, it was kind of just this picture of being like this quiet kind of princess in right. waiting for this person to come along and just like fall in love with you. Mm-hmm. And actually a friend of mine was commenting on this, you know, purity culture and all of this and mentioned how a lot of this I think resulted in women not even knowing how to relate to men at all, like in the context of yeah. the church or just life in general, mm-hmm. because we were just constantly told that we had to, you know, cover ourselves up, make sure that we're not being, you know, flirtatious or provocative.
Right. Yeah.
And, but we also have to be attractive mm-hmm. and quiet and protect their purity and also protect our own purity. Mm-hmm. And it was like, well, it's not worth it. Like we might totally. As well just stay away. Like that was the yeah. kind of the only safe option was just to stay away.
So now be part of the community or yeah, get involved. And that's hard. That's mm-hmm. a lot of like responsibility. First off, that like shouldn't be your responsibility,
yeah.
you know? And it's just, it sucks that a lot of people had to juggle when they shouldn't have, you mm-hmm. know, but here we are in this like culture at the time and again still like today and mm-hmm. it might look different, but like I think it's just very sad to realize that women had to do all that stuff, you know, mm-hmm. and if it just seems like a ton of work emotionally and physically and just draining to hear that there's just all this like guilt and shame that comes along with it, you know, as pastors or people speak this into your life through conferences or books or whatever events, you know, and it's just very sad to see that and to realize like, yeah, look, you you as a woman are responsible to also, if you're married, to like please your husband.
Mm-hmm.
And like you have to do that because it's your job.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter if you're tired or whatever it's going on in your life. Like that is your duty as a wife to get help him get by, you know. And if he sins, if he looks at like porn or if he looks at, if he lusts and stuff, that is your fault.
Yeah.
Like that meant that you didn't work hard enough. You didn't please hard enough or mm-hmm. whatever it is, you know, and that sucks.
Yeah. No, that's the last thing she talks about. Yeah. The woman, the responsibility that's placed on the woman is to satisfy her spouse.
Yeah.
So now again, it's kind of like this switch flips mm-hmm. where now even within the context of marriage,
mm-hmm.
your job, you're told that your job is still to protect the purity of your husband, but now by being that sexual outlet for him.
Yes. And also, like, if he's abusive to you or like he divorces you,
mm-hmm.
there's many stories here that like people have told the woman that, well, that's your fault.
Mm-hmm.
You could have done this better. You could have dressed prettier, put on makeup. And,
yeah.
and there's all, even if people don't say that to you, like there's also that those self guilt and shame and doubts and thinking like, well, maybe I could have done this better
mm-hmm.
if I did this and that, you know?
Yeah.
And so again, it comes back to the quote unquote responsibility of the woman to do all this stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, when in reality it's like, well, that's unbiblical. And like the husband should have been kept accountable. Like that's his own, like, you know, situation that he has to admit, like, you know what? Yeah, this is my fault. And like, this is my issue and here's my sin. I have to like work at that, you know,
mm-hmm.
and to remove that sin and stuff and work our marriage together. It's not yeah. just like a one way street, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she talks about how going from like singleness to marriage, women are just viewed as first a like sexual temptation, and then they're just viewed as a sexual outlet, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let's move on to now talking about chapter 4 is called Male Purity and the Rhetoric of Lust. And so this is kind of the other side of the coin
mm-hmm.
of the messages that men receive in purity culture and also like the underlying things of just how men are portrayed.
Yeah. So yeah, they're portrayed as being these sex machines.
Yeah.
Right? They're fueled by that, and that's what they need.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there's that lust problem, and like women again need to tame them
mm-hmm.
pretty much.
Yeah. Maybe surprisingly, I don't know, this topic of men as sex machines
uh-huh.
was one of the things that stood out the most to me in this book. And one of the things that it was honestly like a sigh of relief to read this and to
yeah.
hear it called out in this way.
I bet, yeah.
Because this was honestly one of the most confusing and frustrating and I think damaging things for me that I mm-hmm. heard in purity culture. And this is another one of those rhetorics that is really paralleled in culture at large, and especially like media.
Yeah.
Is, you know, in movies and TV, men are portrayed this way as well.
Right.
You know, yep. you hear mm-hmm. those comments about like, oh, they just have one thing on their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they're viewed, is they have this like insatiable desire for sex.
Yeah.
And when young women were given these like purity talks, like I remember sitting with a bunch of other like young teenage girls and hearing these older women telling us that like, you don't understand the way that guys think.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it was kind of scary, honestly, the way that it was presented, of like, you don't understand like the things that are going on in their minds.
Mm.
And I don't want to take away from the fact that like, yeah, they were talking to us in the context of like high school, when I understand that that is a little bit different because there are a lot of hormones, you
yeah.
know, at play there for guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so there may be times when it might have felt that way to them, that
yeah.
they did have this like insatiable desire.
Mm-hmm.
And so I understand that. But in general, just having that as like a blanket statement of like, you don't understand how men think, and they just have this like constant desire for sex and for, and are constantly like struggling with lust.
Yeah.
It was just spoken as if it was just an undeniable fact.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is just how it is. And it honestly seemed so crazy to me. I was just thinking that men are like, or, you know, at the time, I guess, thinking about like the guys that were in like my youth group.
Mm-hmm.
I just imagined, because this is what I was told, that they were constantly struggling with lust and like every moment of every day having to like pull their minds back from wanting to lust after people.
Mm-hmm.
So that obviously just gave me such a small view of them. And I remember hearing things about like, oh, you know, pastors telling guys that they should become carpet experts, because every time they saw a girl who was dressed like provocatively, that they were supposed to just look at the ground and like look away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you know, I didn't question it, but I just found it so, honestly, it was just kind of disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that that just like really doubled down on this burden that was put on us to like really make sure that you are not dressing in a way that's going to make that harder for them.
And yeah, it is very crazy to just having the whole mentality of like, we got to bounce your eyes every time someone walks, a woman walks into the room, or, you know, that mentality of like, well, you have to look away. We'll be carpet experts, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
Like in a way, I understand that if you like be aware of your temptations and your lust and be aware of that stuff, you do struggle with that. But there has to be a good balance of like being aware of your temptations and dealing with that, but also all the while like treating women with respect and not objectifying them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and treating them like objects.
Yeah.
Because that just really adds all this big weight on them, you know, and, mm-hmm. and it just makes it really hard to have this like friendship or relationship between brothers and sisters
mm-hmm.
in the Christian community.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to share one other personal story about this because I think this also was something that really solidified this for me of like, okay, I guess this is true. And mm-hmm. That's why, again, this was just so helpful for me to see this rhetoric really pushed back against. And I'll get to that in a second. But
uh-huh.
when I was in college, like college age, I was in a young adults group at my church.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very small group because it was a very small church. And so there were only like, I don't know, like six or seven of us in this group. And then there was one of the pastors
mm-hmm.
was leading it. And there was a guy in the group who was actually about to get married. He was engaged.
Uh-huh.
And he, I think we must have been talking about the topic of lust or like sexual purity or something like that. And he asked the question of the pastor, and this was a, you know, a married pastor. And so this guy who was engaged, he asked the pastor, does the struggle with lust and like sexual temptation go away or like get a lot easier after you're married?
Mm-hmm.
And which I think, you know, that was a fine question for him to ask.
Yeah.
And the pastor's response was, he was like, well, how can I put this delicately? There's an element of experience that kind of opens up like a whole new door of temptation. Mm. And I was just like, okay, so now you're saying that like even, you know, in marriage, even when men are having sex. So, you know, thinking about like my own future at that point, thinking like, okay, even when I am, you know, married and, you know, as a couple, we have the freedom to enjoy sex.
Yeah.
My husband is still going to be tempted and mm-hmm. still going to be this like sex machine. And now even us having sex is now another fuel for him to be tempted more to like lust after other women and, you know, struggle with pornography or whatever it might be. And like, that was so discouraging.
Yeah.
Like that was just so, and you know, and this was coming from like one of the pastors at my church. And I just felt like, well, I guess this is just how it is. And I just was like, okay, well, I guess this is just it. And I don't get it. And I don't like it.
Right.
But this, I guess this is just how it is.
Mm-hmm.
Again, like, I think all of these things, all these teachings and ideas, they come from a place of truth. So I'm not trying to discredit that completely and say like, oh, that's not true at all. Like, there might be an element of truth to that.
Right. Yeah.
That like having sex makes lust or sexual temptation different.
Mm-hmm.
But just the way that it was said, it was almost like I felt like he was just shaking his head at the kid and being like, oh no, you have no idea. Like, it's just going to get harder from here.
And obviously that's not encouraging.
No.
Right? It just puts your guard up more and makes you very fearful and hopeless, I guess, like to think, well, like, you're telling me to work super hard as a woman, and then, well, what does that mean once we're married? It's like, I'll have to do every single thing and to at least have this like tamed like lust or whatever, you know? And so it's very difficult.
And I'm sure it was also discouraging for him as well to think like, and I don't know him super well to know yeah. like what his background was, but you know, he probably also grew up hearing these messages of like, oh, marriage is the finish line. You know, you're saving yourself for marriage. That's the goal.
Yeah.
And now he's like almost there. And then he's now being told like, oh no, like it's just going to get harder for you.
Right.
And like, and you know, and now that idea is being put into his head of like, you are this like sex machine. You are this like,
yeah.
you have this insatiable desire that's like, you're not going to be able to tame.
Yeah.
And I know he didn't say it in that way, but it's just like that. I don't know. That was just super discouraging. And there might be other people who were sitting in that circle who didn't feel that way and who felt like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And I'm sure there's a lot of nuance that could have been explained if there had been more time or whatever, but that's just like, that's how I took it. And that's kind of,
yeah.
I think the message that was, you know, delivered.
Right.
So she talks about how a lot of times in, you know, in the books that are marketed towards men, towards young men, like Wild at Heart and Every Man's Battle, those kind of books, she talks about how, she says, according to one man I interviewed, the church put masculinity in a box too narrow. It was all sports metaphors and let's be pushy and go camping, he told me.
Yeah.
And I thought that that was so well said, beyond even just like zooming out beyond the topic of purity culture, but I think just in general, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
That church culture, I think at least in America or, you know, church culture, I think that it really has done that, of painted this idea of masculinity way too narrow.
Totally.
Of like, this is what a Christian man is supposed to look like, with all of these like battle metaphors. And I think that it's very damaging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, then coupled with the sex machine and like the lust machine rhetoric, it really, she talks about how it doesn't paint men as like whole people.
Mm-hmm.
Just in the same way that women are not painted as whole people, they're just seen as like their body. Mm-hmm. Men in purity culture are just seen as their lust and as their sin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she talks about how men are whole people with feelings and with with desires and with needs outside of sex.
Right, yeah.
And how that really also sets up sex within marriages to be really disappointing for women when they feel like maybe their husband doesn't have like the type of sex drive that they were told that he would.
Yeah.
You know, and that can leave women feeling like there's something wrong with them or that they're like undesired.
Yeah.
Because they just were told that this is what men think about all the time.
Right.
You know, and so it's very like dehumanizing to men as well.
That's true.
Oh yeah. Just a couple quotes I wanted to talk about here from this chapter, and then we can move on to the next topic. But it says, in purity rhetoric for men, women are often depicted as damsels in distress, but also as damsels causing distress. And then jumping down a little bit, it says, Christian books for men focus more on avoiding women than interacting with them. Sadly, there is little room for fellowship within the church between men and women when women are more often talked about as potential stumbling blocks than as sisters in Christ.
Yeah, yeah, that's something I also highlighted here. Sounds like men have been taught to just avoid women or quote-unquote zap them like mosquitoes and just ignore and look away. And that just really objectifies women, and there's more than just the physical body, you know? And so the church could do a lot better to encourage fellowship instead of like causing like this avoidance with between brothers and sisters in the church.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's very sad that that has been talked about in the books, and there's not really a lot of encouragement for men to go up to women and have fellowship. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more like avoid them, don't look at them. They're dangerous. But if you want to marry them, then you have to be careful.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
It's like, well, what is it? There's just kind of very like hard. It's very like, there's a lot of things that just doesn't make sense. Like, well, how could I? It's like walking on eggshells. Mm-hmm. It's just very hard.
Yeah.
For both parties, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. The last thing that I'll say, sorry, I think I said that was the last thing. But the last thing I'll say is actually the thing that she started this chapter with, which was talking about the quote, like Billy Graham rule.
Mm-hmm.
Had you heard of that before?
No.
So that was something that I've heard about before with, I guess that Billy Graham did have this rule of his mm-hmm. own to never be like alone with a woman in a mm-hmm. room, like mm-hmm. with the door closed. And this is one of those things where like there can definitely be a nugget of wisdom and a way to set boundaries that is good mm-hmm. and that is done in a loving way.
Mm-hmm.
But she talks about how this in some contexts has been used as just another way to, that kind of paints women as the problem.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, this goes back to that idea of women's bodies being seen as like a weapon mm-hmm. and as dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I think I've really seen and experienced in a way that was hurtful
mm-hmm.
Of thinking like, feeling like men in the church, like in my church, feeling like it seemed like they had to just be so cautious around like me and other women
yeah.
under this guise of like being above reproach mm-hmm. and maintaining this appearance of righteousness and purity
yeah.
that probably came from a good place.
Yeah.
But it has to be done in a way that is loving
mm-hmm.
and not in a way that just makes women feel like they can't be comfortable. I feel like it creates just this like stiffness where there should be warmth and like a familial, you know, care and love.
Right.
It kind of just creates this awkward, like rigid kind of stiffness.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
The next two chapters, I'm kind of going to put those together. The theme here is she's talking about the promises of purity culture
mm-hmm.
and how purity culture, whether explicitly or implicitly, kind of promises that if you wait to have sex, then you will be promised a amazing, like out of this world sex life within marriage,
mm-hmm.
that you will get married relatively yes. soon.
Yeah.
And that you'll be blessed with children and just this like, you know, great marriage.
Yeah.
And so she talks about the problems with that and how marriage and children is really just placed up on this pedestal in the church.
Yeah. And we've talked about that
mm-hmm.
a lot in the marriage, you know, episode and the singleness episode. So we want to look at that. We spent a whole month talking about the different kind of stages of in a relationship.
Yeah.
And so we talked about like the importance of like singleness, and, you know, single people in Christian churches are just seen as like they don't belong there.
Yeah.
And in this book, I was like, yep, you said it right. Like everything you said, we agree with that. And mm-hmm. And it's true. And so married people are seen as like, you did it, you won, and you are important. And that's it. And so single people, like you'll catch up. You know, and
yeah.
so you'll get there. Here's a promise. All these three things, marriage, children, sex. It's going to mm-hmm. be, everything's going to be wonderful. So those are three things are promised to you. But it sucks that that's promised to everybody when in reality, like that might not happen to a lot, everybody. Like you right. might not get married. You know, might not have sex. You might not have kids,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so that's very important for like the author, Rachel, here mentioned that,
mm-hmm.
that it could really cause a lot of pain because think about it, like we're talking about a culture here, purity culture, and what culture down to that word, like it talks about like people, not just one person, but multiple of people, a community coming together and starting to kind of have this similar type of mentality, behavior, beliefs, and values, and events are created now because we have like a shared common, you know, belief about purity and stuff. So like people for years have walked in and on the purity culture.
Yeah.
And so you as a teenager woman, you believe these three things, these promises and stuff. And then once you're married, for example, but you can't have kids or you can't have like this wonderful sex that you were promised, then you're going to be angry at not just yourself, maybe the husband, but also the church, and you get hurt, you know? Yeah. And that's the reality of it. Like there's stories that Rachel, the author, talks about, like the people that she interviewed, that there were some women that were hurt by this, mm-hmm. by these promises.
Yeah.
That these authors said, you're going to get some beautiful babies. But in reality, like, you know, there's this person that is dealing with infertility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so then I think it does take time for you to then recover from this purity culture.
Yeah.
Because again, you spent every single thing, all these years believing all these things about purity culture. And so that's the reality of it, that you have to deal with the aftermath of this, these false promises.
Yeah. It's like, these things are not a prize for my virginity.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that's a little bit funny, but also very serious, that was talked a lot about in the documentary, it's called I Survived, I Kissed Dating Goodbye.
Mm-hmm. That was referenced in the book, by the way.
Yeah. And they talked about a lot of the purity rallies and events, how they were using sex to sell abstinence. And it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
But it really is true. And this is, I think, what she's hitting on in these chapters, talking about how, and I definitely heard this, like people who report having like the best, most fulfilling sex lives are the ones who waited until they got married.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, if you can just like wait and hold out, then you'll be able to like unleash all of this like sexual desire
yeah.
in marriage. And it's going to be like nothing that you've ever
mm-hmm.
imagined. And that's also just discrediting the fact that people have different like sex drives and sexual desires. And
yeah.
for some people, it's not going to be this like life-changing thing, like on Jane the Virgin.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's just a lie. And
right.
and so she does a really good job also of talking about how the heart behind sexual purity should be Jesus. It shouldn't be mm-hmm. the promise of sex or family or babies.
Yeah.
And one other thing I wanted to say about this real quick is, the way that she worded something I thought was so good when she said that even though like we might say that everybody's welcome and like we value single people, mm-hmm. dating people, whatever, she talked about how the nuclear family, people that are married and have children, are usually at the center of our churches.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was such a good way to put it, because it's not that like, oh, we're saying like, you can't sit with us.
Right.
But it's just more of this thing of like, yeah, those are the people that you always see like front and center.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that have these like important roles are the ones that are spouses and parents.
Right. Yeah. And she mentions going back to like single people, right? Because they have to deal with that of like, well, I'm not there. I mm-hmm. am not the focal point of the church.
Right.
Values and beliefs. And the single people are viewed more as like, well, you have to graduate
yeah.
from singleness from being single to being married. And that's just not the case. Like, I don't think it should be viewed that way. You know, we need to ask ourselves like, why? Like first, like how is our church treating single people? Not mm-hmm. just single people, but also widows, divorced people, like people that are in similar boats with single people. Like, yep, they've been married and have sex and stuff, but now they're in this time of like being single again.
Mm-hmm. Also in chapter 5, she talks about the neglected reality of infertility.
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt very seen mm-hmm. In this section. And it was also something that I had never really like connected those dots of
yeah.
the way that, you know, purity culture promises marriage, sex, and children. And mm-hmm. how that was a big thing that was, again, whether explicitly or implicitly, it was one of the promises, one of those mm-hmm. false promises that was like built up, and and you know, some of the books that are directed at young women talk about like marriage and motherhood being the highest calling for women, which is just a flat out lie.
Yeah.
And so she talks about how the Bible has many stories about infertility, and honestly, when I read that sentence, I was like, I never thought about
that. Put that together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really never thought about that. So she talks about these people from the Bible, Abraham and Sarah, Rachel and Jacob, Hannah, how these couples and these women were dealing with infertility, but it's something that the church doesn't really talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that God understands, but does the church, despite scripture's acknowledgement of infertility, Sarah's waiting and Hannah's weeping, it is a form of suffering that too often goes unaddressed. And so again, she's talking about somebody else that she talked with. It says that this person told her that loving the infertile is more about sitting with them in their grief than giving them false assurance or empty encouragement.
Yeah, I highlighted that part too.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important too. This is very practical.
Like,
to listen.
Yeah.
And don't like give advice if, you know,
mm-hmm.
like that's not really the answer. It's more like listen, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's very important. So I thought it was pretty cool that they included that part there about infertility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one other quote from that, she says, maybe one reason we fail to weep with the infertile is because we're too busy giving them advice. And yeah, I think that's one of those things where I think she says it really well, and just saying that it's a pain that just kind of often goes unaddressed, and that there's a lot of times this advice given of like, I know about this other person who like they couldn't have children and then they decided to adopt and then they ended up getting pregnant, and like I've heard that.
Yeah.
And so she talks about how it's more about, like, I think that's just very well said, that it's more about sitting with and grieving with and acknowledging the pain of people that are going through this, instead of just seeing it as something that can be like, oh, well, you know, have you thought about this? Like, have you thought about adoption? Have you thought about, all these other things, which it's just one of those pain points where for some reason the people's response is a lot more quickly to give advice and give their opinion instead of just sitting with and weeping with.
Yeah.
She concludes the section about infertility by saying this, which I like underlined and put stars next to. It says, it seems we are so uncomfortable with the reality of suffering that our theology has stopped short. Instead of looking to God's word, which is full of sinner saints, suffering, persecution, loss, and infertility, we fumble to explain what God has not answered. We deny the truth of pain. We gloss over what deserves to be mourned, and we cannot comfortably sit in silence with the hurting. This must change.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was just really good.
Yeah, that's good. As we wrap this little section here, chapter 6 talks about the problems with the problems of sex, which I think we talked a lot about. And here it highlights like what sex is, right? And sex is a gift and not a right.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of like interviews and references she got from books that people have said like, sex is a right. Men need to have sex, period. Whenever the man wants it, it has to be done.
Yeah.
Right? Then also it's noted here that sex is not a reward for good behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she just talks about how in purity culture it's just idolized and seen as this ultimate prize, this ultimate human experience, and how that's not the truth of how God views us and how God created us. And she talks about how Jesus was a sexual being because he was human, but he did not have sex.
Yeah.
And how like that and Jesus lived this full and complete and perfect life
as a single man,
and he also did not sin sexually, we know, because he was a perfect human being, but he was also a sexual human being. And she talked about how that's like such an uncomfortable thought to like sit with, and I also thought that too as I was reading it. I was like, that just feels weird,
right?
But she was saying that we've so like contorted like sexuality with sexual sin that it makes us like squirm to think about that Jesus was a sexual being.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the point of of all that was just, you know, she was just saying that the act of sex should not be put as this ultimate human experience, because it isn't. It's a gift, but it's not a right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think that I agree with what she said here, that like how we view sex matters, you know, and sex within marriage is, it's about selfless giving and receiving, not selfish demanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's a quote from the book. And yeah, I think it's important to really understand like what sex is and isn't.
Yeah.
Now, chapter 7, it's called What the Sexual Abused Here. And we talk about, the first thing here is rape culture, impurity culture. It talks about here that rape culture is a social climate of victim blaming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was very important here to talk about rape and to talk about abused women here, and rape and what that looks like within purity culture.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we talked about like how purity culture doesn't really empower women to be heard and mm-hmm. to be loved. And once we hear that someone did something to them sexually,
yeah,
because again, just the instead of putting the man at fault, we put women at fault.
Yeah, it doesn't even equip them to be able to point out that sexual abuse happened.
Yeah.
Because they're just told that they must have done something to provoke it.
Yeah, it's like, well, that's your fault because of the outfit you're wearing or all this stuff. It's like very sad.
Yeah, and that's a part of rape culture at large. But, you know, it's heartbreaking to see how that has been also a part of church culture as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just very kind of mind-boggling to understand that, like, me coming into this culture, Christian culture and community in my adult life without being exposed to it at a, like, very young age, I realized that church to me meant like it was a safe haven,
mm-hmm.
you know, where I could be myself.
Yeah.
And come as I am and come with all this burden and sin and stress of life and of the world, and come here and come to God and come to realize that there's like a secondary family within these brothers and sisters around me, and that I could trust them with my thoughts and feelings and my life experiences and struggles and sin. And it's sad to realize that like purity culture has like just kind of cut that away, like that kind of vision, that similar kind of picture that I have of like the church being a safe haven for women,
mm-hmm.
for them to come to people and share their experiences and stuff. And in reality, it's like, well, you can't really talk about these issues without being accused of being pointed at, like, this is your fault because of what happened. So it sucks. And there's some interviews and stuff that the author shares about like how, like when a certain woman shared about her sexual, unconsented sexual encounter with the man, like how shame and guilt was just bounced back to her, mm-hmm. you know,
mm-hmm.
instead of like having someone there to listen to them and understand and be a listening ear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very sad. And yeah, so we just wanted to mention that big chunk of that chapter. Sucks that like it's this message of like women should know better, so mm-hmm. it's just very, very confusing to me, just again because of like the picture I've had of church, you know, and mm-hmm. to realize like, well, there's some churches out there, maybe not a Samba majority, because I know purity culture was a big culture in church.
Well, and that's really, I think, encouraging actually to hear that, you know, that you didn't encounter that, and that you were, that you did come from a church that was that like safe haven,
mm-hmm.
and that did encourage, and, you know, that did encourage a lot like healthier relationships mm-hmm. between men and women, and just the way that women, you know, were viewed
mm-hmm.
in that church. So that actually is, I think, a really encouraging thing.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing that was really compelling from this chapter was she talked about the biblical account of David and Bathsheba.
Yeah.
Which, if you're not familiar with, you know, David was an Old Testament king.
Yeah.
And the biblical account says that he saw her bathing on her roof and commanded that, like, she be brought to him. And he slept with her and they had a child.
Yeah.
She talked about how in the Bible, David is the one who is solely put, like, the responsibility is solely put on him. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who, like, takes responsibility for it. And he's the one who the sin is, like, placed on.
Yeah.
And also talks about how in the book, she talks about how David was also in a position of power. He was the king.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, but think about the way that you may have heard the account of David and Bathsheba told in your churches. You know, was Bathsheba painted out to be this, like, seductress who was prancing around in public naked for men to see? Were they seen as, like, partners in this sin?
Mm-hmm.
Or was she seen as a victim of sexual abuse or, you know, possibly rape?
Yeah.
Especially when you consider the position of power that David held as the king. And that was really eye-opening to me as well, because I think that many times there was that kind of eyebrow raise of, like, well, what exactly was Bathsheba doing on that roof?
Yeah.
And why was she? And instead of seeing this account for what it is and for what the Bible, you know, says that it is, that it was David's sin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that was also just really, like, just very compelling.
Totally. Yeah, I concur.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much our last ride here, chapter 8, 9, 10.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with chapter 8 here, submitting to God's sexual ethic as embodied souls.
Yeah.
It really is a great reminder that, again, that we need to recognize that Jesus is the one who makes us pure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. It's not like your other behaviors you need to apply in your life to make you pure.
Yeah.
It's Jesus at the end
mm-hmm.
of it all. And we could obviously do stuff to, like, live that pure life, but it's not like, well, that's the answer for you to have purity.
Right.
It's like for you to dress this way, behave this way, think this way.
Yeah.
You know, and she mentions here that, like, yep, like, there's all these purity conferences, events that kids, teenagers sign up, but they forget the main thing. You know, they have forgotten the main thing, and that is Jesus to be talked about and mentioned in these conferences. And so that be, like, the focal point and to realize that Jesus is the one that makes you pure.
Yeah, she says, I thought this was really good. She said, so many of us walked right past the gospel on our way to a purity conference.
Right. Yeah. So we're leaving out the gospel, we're leaving out the Jesus part when it comes to purity conferences.
Yeah.
That it's more focused about, like, here's how you tame yourself. That's how the sexual being is you're supposed to deny your sexual being until marriage and you'll get there. But it's just living out, like, falling on your knees and repenting and having Jesus be, like, the answer, you know, and being the one that will help you.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much kind of the answers of that chapter. And I think that's true. You know, I agree with that. And it's pretty good. And I think it's important to really think about, like, how do we view sex? How do we view sexual purity? And throughout this whole book, actually, we didn't mention this, but at the end of each chapter, there are some discussion questions and an activity that you could do with, like, a small group, with a couple people or a larger group. And I think it's pretty cool to have this interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout this whole book, she talks about the importance of bringing these things to light and not just reading about it and that's it.
Yeah.
And just calling in a day. It's like attending a conference. Like, well, no, you got to apply it.
Yeah.
You got to apply these things and not just keep it within you, but have people that you could have in your life that you could talk about your sex life and that you could mention the word sex and sexual and all these things and feel okay about it, mm-hmm. and to have honest conversations about certain struggles as married couples or as a single guy or a woman or as a divorced person. Like, I think that the more diverse the group is, this is what she says, it's better.
Yeah.
And I really agree with that. And I believe that it doesn't matter how old or young you are or what status you have. Like, I think it's very important that to have people that look different than you, that think differently than you. I think that that's going to add more into this like big pot that you're brewing here. And I think that it's going to be cool to have that type of fellowship,
mm-hmm.
either within church or outside of church. Like, I think it's pretty good to have that conversation to start, not just like to start, not just to start and end it by reading this book and that's it, but to let this be something that you could apply in life by having discussions.
Yeah.
You know, and asking certain questions. I wrote down a couple questions here. Chapter one, there was a couple questions here that I thought was pretty cool. It says, what comes to your mind when you hear the term purity culture? And then what were you taught about sex and marriage growing up? I think these are pretty cool questions to think about, you know, and I think that, like, watch what might happen if you do bring these things up, you know, in your group as you're focusing up on purity culture and sex and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's just a lot of good questions there. And along with that, chapter 9 talks about, like, what will we tell our children? And we're not there yet. Like, we haven't had the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm definitely looking forward to it. Here, the book, the author challenges us to not just have like the talk, like a one and done thing,
yeah.
and move on, that's it, but to have ongoing discussions. And I think it's good to apply these conversations in your daily life with your other adults in your life. And then I think that would make it easier to have those talks with your teenager,
that's
with
true,
your kid,
yeah. mm-hmm.
you know. I think that it's a good question to have in mind. It's like, what are we going to tell them?
Yeah.
You know, about sex, about purity culture, about being pure, about Jesus being the answer and stuff. Like, so I think that it's cool to have these things in mind already. And so, yeah, I think that after reading this book, I really am hopeful that we're going to have ongoing discussions that are honest and pure and sometimes messy, but good, mm-hmm. you know, with yeah. our kids. Yeah, I think the author also just continues to talk about, like, the importance of fellowship and the importance of having friends within the gender, outside of the gender. Like, I think it's important to have those conversations within the Christian community. And I think it's also cool to just realize, you know what, like, we could also just challenge, like, the church as well, and, like, in a way of, like, just reevaluating certain things that have been said to you, like, from years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that growth is a thing that will happen in, you know, and yourself and your group and stuff. I think the more that you really break down these answers to these questions of, like, what is purity culture to you, you know, and what you're going to do with when your kid comes up to you and has certain issues that they have going on, you know. So, yeah, I think those are kind of my final thoughts as far as, like, chapter 8, 9, and 10.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, what do you think?
Well, when in the chapter that you talked about, you know, God's sexual ethic as embodied souls, that she talks about, you know, submitting to God's sexual ethic. Mm-hmm. And I think that chapter was really good. There was sort of a tendency in me to leaning toward, like, throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Mm.
And as I started to realize all of the damage that had been done by purity culture,
uh-huh.
I think it's kind of, it can be really easy, and it was for me to sort of start thinking down the line of, like, well, I don't want to have any conversations about modesty or mm-hmm. about, you know, saving sex till marriage and all of that, because, like, there was so much damage that was done, right. and it was presented in such a harmful way.
Yeah.
And so she talks a lot about how God's design is perfect
mm-hmm.
and how it is very good. And she talks about being able to submit to what God says about sex without having this burden of what purity culture and of what other people have told us
yeah.
about that. And mm-hmm. So I think that was really encouraging for me to see the way that, you know, she's pushing back so much against this rhetoric and against this subculture without veering from like what God says is true. And so she talks about how the church has really missed the mark when it comes to talking about purity culture, but that it's still so important to stay, to stand firm on what God says about about sexuality and about his design for for sex, and but also about, you know, it says like as embodied souls, so also about God's design for people in general. And like you were talking about, you know, she says how, I think she says something about like how we've painted the circle of intimacy too small, and how intimacy is not about sex, and like intimacy is not just sex. The intimacy is supposed to be found in the church and amongst our brothers and sisters. So she talks a lot about just seeing God's design for humans as a whole, and how his desire for our obedience and for our obedience to him when it comes to sex is important, but it is not what saves us. And it's not what makes us pure. He's the one, like you said, he's the one who makes us pure, who makes us righteous, who loves us and saves us. And that's not anything that we can do or earn. And, you know, she talks about how Jesus is at the center of all of this. And it's not about, you know, virginity or purity. So that was just really encouraging for me to read that. And she, and, you know, and she refers to it as countercultural, how the idea that sex is designed for marriage is countercultural, and that is something that it might, that that is going to be, you know, unpopular to say, and that it will probably offend people.
The world we live in, right, it's very common to hear about sex and sitcoms now and today's world and movies and stuff, and it's very like okay, like all these modern shows and movies and stuff really painting the picture of like it is okay to have sex outside of marriage, right? And it's totally fine and encouraged.
And you know, she talks about how our focus just needs to be on God and on following him, you know, day by day. And that, you know, the things that don't make sense to us or whatever, we can like submit those to him and trust him. But anyway, it was just encouraging to me to not like just throw out everything.
There is hope, and there's people like this author, and there's people that have read this book that like were hurt by purity culture, and that could really like say yes and amen to all these like stories, and to partner with these women and, you know, and their stories. And like, again, like those three words at the beginning, like to the abused, I think that really stood out to me, just because I realized that, well, this is going to like, you know, be very powerful for the abused. Again, my final thoughts here is that like this book was great. We loved it. Rachel was a well put. I think that she really described what purity culture was, and for me as an outsider looking in, it really captivated the problems and issues of purity culture, and the problems of like certain conferences and books and certain media that was voicing this like way to live life and this way to be pure. I really recommend that for anybody that is someone like me, that is a guy that, you know, in a way wasn't affected or hasn't heard the term purity culture, or someone that was, you know, affected by it and lived it and signed pledges, you know, and all that. And I think it's very good for anybody, and hopefully they have a open mind and, you know, to realize like what the pain that has caused, and again, like unfortunately, like still caused, you know, it's being created in women and guys. And so, overall, there is hope that like there's people out there that, like that we could
come together and relate, you know, and with this pain and stuff. And so anybody out there's listening and relates to all this stuff that we talked about, we're glad that you're here and joining us.
Yeah. Yeah. Overall, it was honestly really encouraging. A big part of the encouragement was, like I said, having things that I experienced and thought about and that it affected me put into words, and mm-hmm. also to see those rebuked and to see those yeah. pushed back against. That was really, really helpful and really mm-hmm. encouraging to me. And also to see how, you know, her conclusion, she talks about at the beginning how this is not a vendetta against the church. It's out of love for the church.
Yeah.
And to see how her conclusion was not to say that the biblical view of sexuality is wrong.
Totally. But yeah.
But that the, you know, the biblical view of sexuality was perverted by purity culture, and that yeah. it was used as a weapon against us mm-hmm. rather than seen as, you know, what, how God intended it, and that yeah. that is not the heart of God.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was really encouraging, definitely very heavy in some places, but overall I think it was just so well put and just showed that there's definitely a lot of work to be done.
Totally.
And I think that that's going to happen, you know, like you said, just in conversation with other mm-hmm. people, and, you know, and hopefully just moving forward as we talk to our own children, talk mm-hmm. to other people, that we can change the way that this is talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's our final thoughts, and it is a long episode, but we wanted to just be honest and just share what we thought and talk about the book, break it down from cover to cover. Thank you so much for listening with us, and thanks so much for being part of this. We really appreciate that. And again, if you relate with the stuff we talked about, we would love to connect with you, and we're glad you're here. And we recommend this book. Again, it's called Talking Back to Purity Culture, written by Rachel Joy Walcher. And so, yeah, we recommend that as a Christmas gift. I think it's a cool idea. Books, I think it's pretty cool to give knowledge in a shippable book. So go do that. And then if you would like to support us, you could do that by giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcast. If you're listening to us on Apple, if you don't, then maybe give us a big shout out on your social media platforms. That would help us as well. And also just word of mouth or whatever you want, posters or whatever you want to do. We really would appreciate this shout out. So thank you so much in advance.
And as Rachel Joy Walcher says, to the hurting, the abused, and the angry, the weary, the curious, and the skeptical, to those whose faith is smaller than a mustard seed, and to those who, after experiencing the rough and tumble of life, still cling to the hem of Jesus' robe, you will not be put to shame.
See you next time.
Hey, thanks for listening all the way to the end. Now you can enjoy this sneak peek of next week's episode. Obviously, as your children get older, they realize that you aren't perfect.
Yeah.
And I think that that's good and normal. And I don't want our kids to believe everything, to believe that we're like perfect and that everything we think and say is true. But
speak for yourself.
Whatever.